ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
We're going to talk the economy. Stephen Koukoulas, Managing Director of Market Economics, joins us. Stephen, good evening to you and welcome back.
Thank you, Philip. Good to be back.
Yes, well, lots to talk about too. 1-300-800-222 is the number if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question. Or you can text questions, of course, on 0467922702. So please join the conversation. Thank you, Paul, by the way. It says, Phil, the first storm over the Lockyer Valley now is heading towards Brisbane. Yeah, well, look, I know. We'll keep our eye on it, Paul. And as I say, keep your radio tuned to ABC Radio because there'll be emergency broadcasting announcements for you. All right, relatively calm where we are, but not in many parts of the country. How's the economy doing, Stephen? Calm, stormy? What's the weather forecast?
Look, it's looking a little bit better compared with where we were, say, a year ago.
Yeah, why is that?
Before we had the rate cuts, we had inflation had only just really started to ease off. Wages growth was still pretty tepid. And here we are towards the end of 2025. We've had three rate cuts. We've had an improvement in real wages growth. They've been growing for about 2 years now, not by a huge amount, but nonetheless, wages are increasing by a faster pace than inflation. Mm. And dare I say, and I'm sure we'll touch on this through the course of the hour, that high house prices actually add to consumer wealth. They add to our ability, collectively this is, to spend a little bit more money. And that's feeding into, as you alluded to at the start, a bit of a better story for retail sales and household spending. And that, of course, is the engine of the whole economy. And that's why we've got better conditions. Look, things aren't fantastic. Look, the economy's not booming, but it's better today than it was a year ago.
Really? Okay. It's not all doom and gloom, in other words.
Not all doom and gloom. And all of this is occurring, too, with the other thing that really matters to an economy, of course, is what happens to the labour market. And even though the unemployment rate has crept up over the last 18 months or so, at 4.3%, which is the latest number from the Bureau of Statistics, it's still relatively low. Anything much below 5% or certainly 4.5% is good. We're close to full employment, and that means that everybody who wants a job can relatively quickly find a new job, and I think that's the definition the Reserve Bank used. Mm. And I think that's the situation now. So if we've got a labour market and low unemployment, which is good news for the economy, we've got wages increasing by a little bit more than the rate of inflation, we've got a housing construction, not house prices, but housing construction's finally starting to lift after a period of really deep downturns, then some of these indicators are flashing a sort of a positive sign for the economy as we look forward to 2026.
Mm. Yeah, unemployment's interesting, isn't it? Because there'll be plenty of listeners who remember some years ago about unemployment and how governments were agonising how to get it down from, you know, the levels it was at, 8 or 9 percent. Yes. To getting it to 6% was seen as optimistic. We're at 4.3% now, which some economists, I'd like your thoughts on this. I mean, some people say that is pretty much full employment. Is it? I mean, how do we measure these things anyway?
It's a moving feast, and what is complicating it, and this is my excuse as an economist for trying to sort of give a bit of a caveat here, is that in this current climate of incredible technological change, artificial intelligence, you know, taking over some of the jobs in the economy, and Alan Kohler wrote a fantastic piece on the ABC website today about that, mm. is that, you know, we're moving rapidly towards the automation, at least, roboticization, if that's a word, of the economy. And so some jobs, many jobs, depending on who you listen to, will be obsolete over the course of the next 5 or 10 years. And in fact, some have already become largely obsolete. You know, think of bank tellers, for example, or people who used to count the checks in the banking system, or people on the Sydney Harbour Bridge who used to collect the toll with, you know, just putting out their hand as you drove through. That's just a tiny example of how automation has changed the economy, which is a roundabout way of me saying that it's very hard to know exactly where we have full employment, but definitely in this low 4-4.5% range where we've been for the best part of a year now. It's still low. It's still pretty good. The test will be in the course of the next 6 to 12 months. What happens to wages growth? If wages growth were to pick up, that would suggest that maybe the labour market is, as we say in economics, too tight. But if we have wages growth just chugging along at that 3.5% or thereabouts in annual terms, it suggests that we are at full employment.
Because, I mean, the unpleasant truth is that the Reserve Bank wants unemployment to be fairly, I don't want to say fairly high, but they don't want the lowest possible unemployment, do they? I mean, because they're worried about inflation. They think that'll push inflation up. If they think the labour market's too tight, that means people want higher wages, and that means higher inflation. I mean, this is, yes. I mean, this is, I mean, it might be unpalatable, but it's true, isn't it? That the Reserve Bank does not want everyone. They want an unemployment rate, don't they?
They do, and this is they want. As I sort of touched on before, they want the labour market to sort of have a position where everybody who wants a job can find a job relatively easily. Now, there's always going to be some unemployment. People who have left the workforce because they just resigned from their old job and they haven't started their new job. They start in 2 months' time. The way the statistician calculates it, they'll be counted as unemployed. So they sort of aren't unemployed, if you know what I mean, but there's going to be this little bit of a lag between changes in the labour market conditions. But that said, where the RBA, and this is where wages growth that is too high, in inverted commas, is the problem that the Reserve Bank fret about so frequently, is that if I'm a company manager, I need to find extra workers because my business is doing so well, and I need to retain my workers, I'm going to have to give them a big pay rise. And if I'm to maintain my profitability, how do I do that? I put up my prices to try to cover those costs. Putting up my prices is, by definition, higher inflation. So that's why the Reserve Bank, even though they don't say it explicitly, realise implicitly that there's got to be some level of unemployment. Now, whether that's 3.5%, 4%, 4.5%, or 5% that they're happy to tolerate remains to be seen. But for the here and now, and from what the Reserve Bank has said recently, this figure in between 4% and 4.5% is something that they're pretty content with.
Yes, one of my texters says this is rehashed 1959 economic theory. Working 1 hour a week is not a good guide to the employment rate. Yeah, look, we usually get complaints about the way they measure unemployment, but it is fair to say, isn't it, that it's always been measured like this. I mean, there's been people accuse the government of manipulating the rate. Well, I don't think, in fairness, that's correct, is it?
No, it's certainly not correct. And it's the same. There's a crowd called the International Labour Organization. Yeah, I think they're a subset of the OECD. And they standardise economic data around the world, whether it's you're measuring GDP or the labour market or the inflation rate. They have these benchmarks that most statistical departments around the world follow. And certainly the Australian Bureau of Statistics do that as well. So that 1 hour a week issue, which, by the way, less than 0.1% of the workforce only works 1 hour a week. But it also only counts as one person being employed if you work a 60-hour week. So if you're one of these people that happens to be frantically busy for whatever reason and you do a 60-hour week, you're only counted as one employed as well. So there are some offsets both on the, 1 or 2 hours a week.
Do we have any figures about that? Because whenever we talk about this, that seems to me anecdotally to be a thing that often people who are working are working too much, to work less. There is underemployment as well. I'm fully aware of that, but there's also overemployment in the sense that a lot of people in jobs would like to be working less, wouldn't they?
And that's where this legislation came through, where people, when they get home from work, don't want their bosses ringing them up and while they're having their dinner and bathing the children or getting ready for bed, and so they can sort of turn off from these excessive hours. And this is one thing that technology has enabled, of course, that your boss can email you or text you or ring you, and of course we all have our phones glued to our the palm of our hand or to our ears or whatnot. And so we can be contacted very, very easily. So in a funny way, do you count that as work? Yeah, I don't think the Bureau of Statistics actually do, but I can assure you that, you know, sometimes in the evening when I'm listening to the radio or whatever and there's a little bing on my phone and it's a work-related issue, I'll look at it, and that is indeed work.
Mm. Yeah, just on inflation, by the way, you say a lot of the price rises in September quarter, you know, because there was a little blip in inflation, were administered prices, like the reversal of electricity and childcare subsidies. So the underlying inflation, you think, is quite positive, is it?
Yes, it's good that we all got a shock with the inflation number for the September quarter that came out towards the end of last month. It was 1.2% for the quarter, 3.2% for the year, and that was way above the Reserve Bank and I think the market economists' expectations for that figure. Mm. But when we dig into the numbers, what we call administered prices, that is council rates that the local governments implement, public transport fares, which a lot of state governments charge, things like postage rates have gone up. And again, the phasing out of electricity and childcare subsidies are all government issues. And so what we see in that inflation numbers was there was a big preponderance of those, because the September quarter by definition includes the 1st of July, the first day of that quarter, and that's the start of the financial year. So a lot of these price changes occurred in July that obviously fed into that number. They're unlikely to be repeated, so that's the good news, not repeated in the next quarter anyway. Mm-hmm. And when we look at market prices, that is the price of items, goods and services that are determined by how much we all spend and how much we invest and these sorts of things, they're actually relatively well contained and only increased by about 2.2% in the year. So the things that interest rates can impact, the price pressures of those was well contained. The things that governments, Commonwealth, state and local influence, that was where the price pressures were showing up in that inflation rate.
Mm. 1-300-800-222 is my number. I'm talking to Stephen Kokoulis. He's Managing Director of Market Economics. If you've got an economic question that's puzzled you, or you'd like to make a comment, or you've got your soapbox out, that's fine too. 1-300-800-222, that's what we're here for. Sam from Yagoona. G'day, Sam.
Yes, good evening, Philip and Stephen. I'm going to ask a very unusual question.
Mm.
On the first Tuesday in November, which is Melbourne Cup,
yes,
a half hour before the Melbourne Cup, RBA do the they tell you the rate for that month.
Mm-hmm.
But every other month, and previously for many years, they used to do it on the first Tuesday of every month. Why has it all changed?
I know the answer to that, and it's because when Jim Chalmers became Treasurer after the 2022 election, he had an inquiry into the functioning of the Reserve Bank, because if we look back, the Reserve Bank, to be blunt, didn't do a good job in the prior years to that, because remember former RBA Governor Philip Lowe saying that, you know, we're not going to hike interest rates for 3 years, and in fact that was a bad decision. So anyway, Dr. Chalmers, the new treasurer, had a review of the Reserve Bank, and one of the things that they decided was to meet less frequently. So instead of the 11 meetings per year, they didn't ever meet in January. They're all at the beach and holiday and whatnot, watching the cricket. They reduced those 11 meetings to 8, and now they time them to come shortly thereafter, the quarterly GDP figures and the quarterly inflation numbers. And by definition, there's only 4 of each of those per year. They include those new numbers in their new forecasts and base their decision to put rates up, to put them down, to leave them steady on that new information on inflation. So that's why they've changed all these other dates, but coincidentally, they kept that first Tuesday in November. So for us economists, we're rapidly going between the economic form and the horse racing form.
That's right. Yeah, well, thank you very much, Stephen, for letting us all know this. A lot of people wouldn't know this.
No, but it was only just part of the reforms. The other thing that it was important to remember too, and this is where, you know, Philip and I discussing the unemployment rate a few moments ago was such an important thing, because while the RBA always had an eye on the labour market, you know, unemployment and wages growth, those sorts of things, it had the highest weighting to what it did to keeping inflation under control at between that 2-3% per annum. with the new operations of the Reserve Bank, of course, they're still keeping inflation between 2 and 3%, but they're giving a higher importance to the level of unemployment. So if we had the unemployment rate increasing rapidly or to a level that was clearly too high, that would actually influence their decision to put interest rates lower.
Well, I understand. Well, thank you very much.
No worries, Sam. Good on you.
Fantastic. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. 1-300-800-222. Dan says, so that means the Reserve Bank board members are getting paid less now that they meet fewer times. Is that right?
I haven't checked that. I'm not sure, but I think they're working a little bit harder too because they're much more accountable. That's the other part of the reform that they publish in detail the minutes. The governor and deputy governor are giving more talks and speeches and press conferences and the like. So I'm not sure whether they're getting paid any less because they're meeting less often.
All right, Steve in St Mary's. G'day, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. What's up?
Having been unemployed and employed over the years, I have to dispute your claim that the Bureau of Statistics does not use 1 hour a week as an indication of full employment. As a job seeker, I have to be willing to work an hour, and if I do work an hour, I am counted as fully employed. So I dispute that. I also dispute...
I don't think we were saying that wasn't the case, Steve. Were we,
Steve? You were answering my question earlier, and he did say that. He said he didn't think the Australian Bureau of Statistics used the 1 hour limit.
No, they do use the 1 hour.
No, I said they do, Steve. I said we get asked this question a lot, and I said there's some accusation that the government manipulated this or changed this. But
no, I wasn't making that claim. I agree with that.
Yeah.
But the other problem is that your explanation of profits is dated. You didn't mention shrinkflation, where the companies reduce the size of the package but keep the price the same. You didn't mention the supply crunch, which the Reserve Bank paid no attention to when they raised interest rates. You're just focusing on the fact that if wages go up, which they haven't since 2013 until recently, that therefore they've got to raise their prices. Companies do having worked in big companies, investment banks, companies do everything in their power to make money no matter what. Collusion, backdoor deals, government pressure.
Yep, well, Steve, sorry, that's your Steve and also Stephen Koukoulas. Stephen, you might want to comment on that.
Yeah, just briefly. Look, the labour costs are only one part of a business's costs that they have to either pass on or absorb or get benefits from if they've got very low wages growth. Of course, they're only a small part of it because the other part that firms can make profits, and Steve's right, firms are there in business to make a decent profit for their shareholders. They can also have productivity improvements, and this is going back to that technological change. And if they can do something by getting better equipment, machinery, computers to do something more efficiently, they should invest in it, and so they should, because that's part of the productivity problem that we're confronting at the moment. Or they can sell more of their stuff. So if they can sort of innovate and think of an item that we consumers would love to buy, that's a better version than what their competitors are producing. The car market's a classic case of that, where there's the choice of cars is mind-numbing, to be frank. So what car do I buy? Well, the best price, the most fuel efficient and all the rest of it, the best resale value. There's a myriad of issues that we all look at car sales, for example. Labour costs are just one of the issues, but that's where the Reserve Bank do put considerable weight, because if wages are increasing, and I'll use inverted commas, by too much, that firms will use that as an excuse to put up their prices unfairly, I think it's fair to say, and I agree with Steve on that. That yes, there are some unfair price increases that I think we found in the supermarket inquiry last year, or early this year, I should say, that were seen to be sort of at least hitting at price gouging, which is a horrible thing for big business to do.
Which they do.
Yes.
Which they do. Yeah. All right, Steve. I don't think we're that far apart, Steve, but thank you. 1-300-800-222. Yes, to those inquiring about what's going on with the storms, keep your radio tuned to ABC Radio. There'll be some local emergency warnings on ABC Radio locally for you. We just had a severe storm warning and loud thunder, lightning, but no rain yet. Probably hit about 11 p.m. Yeah, look, that's right. As I say, keep your radio tuned to ABC, and there'll be emergency warnings for you. It's been a rough 2 days, and there's no end in sight by the look of it. We've got numbers 3-1-300-800-222. I'm talking with Stephen Koukoulis. We're talking economics, interest rates, unemployment, spending, house prices, all of that. You might have some other questions of your own. 1-300-800-222. Lines are free. Rodney from St Arnaud. G'day, Rodney.
G'day. How are we going?
Not bad.
Thank you for your program. A very enjoyable to listen to.
Thank you.
My little concern, the Bendigo Bank has had a deterioration in their prices in the last couple of weeks, a considerable amount taken off the top, and the reports that I read, it's just a slight little concern. What's your thinking on them?
Yeah, look, I saw the Bendigo Bank problems come through, and I think they've got a compliance issue with some of their assessment of how their clients launder money and the like, without getting into the fine details of those sorts of things. But yes, you're quite right. Their share price has been absolutely smoked, as they say in the classics, in recent times. And I think that's the way that investors respond to, be it Bendigo Bank or any other company that's got some, you know, internal mechanisms that aren't quite compliant with the various rules and regulations that they must comply with. Of course, you know, if you're a shareholder in those companies and your company is not doing the right thing, then of course they're going to be punished, they're going to lose business and clients. So, look, I think it might have been overblown. Look, markets react in a very savage way nowadays, and I think we've seen many examples over many years of history of companies that have done the wrong thing, their share price has been hit, and then they repair their shortcomings and all of a sudden they recover again. So I don't know enough about Bendigo Bank to sort of say any more than that.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Rodney. 1-300-800-222 is the number. I liked your little piece you wrote recently about economic policies, about making us better off, and and that issues relating to the management of the economy are important for all of us, because mismanagement can have disastrous consequences. As you say, when you look back at some of the terrible decisions that have been made in the past, you can point to quite a few, can't you, that we're still living with the consequences of. Now, might I dare raise a matter called the carbon tax, for example, the carbon price. But the fact that we abandoned all of that, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, was negative for the economy, wasn't it?
Looking back at bad decisions, most of them relate to tax policy. You're quite right. So be it the carbon tax, be it the negative gearing, dare I mention that, capital gains tax concessions and these sorts of things, which have distorted the housing market, have distorted the way that we have our companies producing energy, and even the GST, which I am a sort of a pretty solid fan of. When it was implemented back in 2000 by Treasurer then Peter Costello, he did a really good job of getting the GST to sort of be implemented. However, in getting it through the Senate, I recall very strongly at the time that he had to compromise again on what was included, what was excluded, that all the payments had to go to the states. So we have this bun fight right now over the GST allocation to the state governments. And my good friend Saul Eslake, who's another wonderful economist, he sort of got a bee in his bonnet about how much...
We had a talk with him recently on the program. He certainly got up the noses of Western Australian listeners.
Yes, first of all, they're the strongest economy in the country, and their budget's in the best position. The state government's raking in billions of dollars from iron ore royalties, and then the rest of us in the other states are subsidising them even more. So, yes, there's some policy stinkers that are there. Hopefully they get unwound or pared back or offset by a few good policies, because, yes, we've had a few good policies implemented as well.
One of the things that gets up people's nose regularly, and we discussed it here on the program not so long ago, Stephen, was the fact that big corporations frequently do not pay tax. And people don't understand this and are rightly angered by it. Now, I know over the years there have been, well, when I say don't pay tax, I mean big companies like Santos, for example, pay little or no tax for a long time. Now, why is this? And the reasons are to do with their ability to write things off. Now, there have been a lot of suggestions over the years. In fact, I think there's a current series of suggestions, aren't there, that we ought to be replacing the corporate taxes with some form of turnover tax. Because, I mean, everyone likes the GST because it's hard to avoid. If you buy something, you pay it. And there ought to be some sort of equivalent for corporate taxes. Why has this been so hard to get off the ground?
That's a very good question. I think there are some big companies that will be lobbying against it. I think
Of course there are.
Yeah, the turnover tax is actually a pretty good idea because it's akin to the GST that you and I and all the listeners as consumers, while a few items are exempt from the GST, basically when you spend a bit of money, you pay the 10%, and that's sort of just absorbed and we pay it and life moves on. And the revenue that they collect on that does help pay for schools and hospitals and those sorts of things. So that works quite well. You're quite right that people get very annoyed, and including a lot of the big multinationals who pay effectively no tax in Australia either. So, the big, Amazons and whatnot pay, even though we use them a lot as consumers and they make, bucket loads of money from us, they don't pay much tax. So some sort of turnover tax in addition to a company tax, which taxes the profits, would be a wise combination, like the GST tax spending.
Yeah, but the problem. I just want to jump in here and say this: the trouble with taxing profits is that companies manipulate their accounts, and with transfer pricing, they never make any profits, even though they do. And we saw this example with Optus, for example, who simply have cost centres in Singapore, where everything's booked in Singapore, which has extremely low tax rates, even though they made all the money in Australia. Now, the opportunities for manipulating what profit you make are manifest with corporations. So the joy of a turnover tax would say, well, hang on, you did all your business in this country. That's where the turnover was. So this is how much tax you're going to pay. And it's hard to avoid. Yeah.
So if you sold $1 billion worth of goods and services in Australia, you pay 3% tax. It doesn't have to be a very high level of tax, just by the way, to collect a lot of revenue, to collect more than the company tax rate, because we know that spending in Australia from us consumers and the other businesses is a couple of $1 trillion a year. So if you think about sort of 3 or 4% of that, I think it was either the Productivity Commission or the Grattan Institute, I can't remember which one, was advocating a rate sort of in the 4% region, and they estimated that would give that would sort of more than offset any loss if we got rid of the company tax regime that we've currently got. So it raises a lot of money, and as you said, it collects a lot of revenue from businesses that, for whatever reason, they're headquartered in Dublin or Bermuda or Singapore.
Well, they manipulate. I'm not blaming them, because they're taking advantage of the tax rules that allow them to. But this is wrong. They're not paying their fair share.
And it's a global phenomenon because this is the same problem that occurs everywhere else. So these big multinationals or big companies that are based in Germany or the UK or in Singapore itself, they headquarter their businesses elsewhere so that they don't pay the tax in the US or in Canada or the UK as well. So there's a lot of tax discussions going on from finance ministers around the world. Yeah. But you only need a couple of places like the Bahamas or Bermuda to break ranks, and then everyone will set up their headquarters there. It's got to be universal.
I know that, and that's what they do at the moment, right? But the joys of turnover taxes are that you can't, because if you spent the money, if you made the money here, then it gets booked here. I mean, it's a bit like the GST. I mean, people can't avoid the GST. They can't say, oh, I didn't buy it down the road. I mean, I bought it in Ireland or I bought it in the Bahamas. You didn't. And you got the receipts, and the receipts are there to prove it. So, there doesn't seem a willingness by governments to go hard on this, for reasons which I think has to do with the fact that they're worried that businesses will relocate elsewhere or whatever. But, hang on, if there's money to be made in Australia, they'll want to make it, won't they?
They will, and indeed that's the issue that we still, if you look around our economy and just think about what we do, and while we all have a bit of a a loyalty to buy Australian when we can. If we've got the same product that's just as good quality and the same price, if not cheaper, yeah, I'll buy Australian, you know, any day, every day of the week to help our local economy. However, we don't make cars, for example. We don't make mobile phones. We don't quite have the logistical means of Amazon and all those other social media platforms that we so rely on. So there's this whole situation where we do, you know, use these foreign entities, and they're always going to be part of the Australian economy. So again, Philip, I'm on your page. I think that some form of turnover tax would be an excellent way to collect revenue from some of these big companies. And again, the reason why we're talking tax is that we, the voters, want decent healthcare. We want good education. We want good aged care. We want a well-funded ABC. We want a whole lot of things like that. And a lot of those things cost money. But you know, we're happy to pay a little tax if everybody else pays their fair share.
Yeah, I know. Because if, I mean, you know, there's a powerful argument to say that taxes like income tax, or for that matter, company tax, you know, are so ridden with holes that we need a better approach to it. But here I am. I mean, I'm probably banging my head against a brick wall here because governments just don't seem to have any appetite for this anymore, do they? The only tax changes they want to bring in are cuts in taxes.
And I think that's the issue. Neither side of politics that I'm aware of advocating for anything significant on the tax front. And as you alluded to, you know, the year before an election's due, whoever's in power will say, oh, look, we'll give a, you know, $10 a week tax cut to some part of the economy, or $20 if they happen to have a bit more revenue in the budget, or whatever the case may be. There's rarely a decision to tighten tax policy to make sure that we, you know, can fund the things that we, the community, want the government to provide.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Line's free if you want to ask a question, or you might have a beef of your own. You've probably heard a bit of mine. Ross from Yokin. G'day, Ross in WA. Hi, Ross.
Yeah, g'day, mate. Thanks for the program. Look, I want to chuck a philosophical proposition past you. Companies are in business to make money, and they have to provide dividends to their shareholders.
Which is fair enough, yeah.
Yep, exactly. But there also needs to be a sense of social responsibility, and the best companies in the country are those that understand their social responsibility. So there's got to be a balance. The market economy has proven to be very successful, but there needs to be, it can't just all be left to government. And so companies, instead of finding ways to avoid tax and to minimise staff, I mean, a classic example is the banks shedding staff all over the country. Now, surely there's a social responsibility there, not just their responsibility to the shareholders. What's your opinion?
Yeah, look, the issue of a social license, if you like, from the business sector is a very, very important one. But they do need encouragement to meet that social license, which is why we have rules and regulations on how they behave. So we do know that, for example, the banking sector is very highly regulated. You know, in years gone by, we've seen them implementing a range of horrendous lending practices. You think back to the Christopher Skase and Alan Bond in the late 80s, I think it was, and some of the issues of the state banks in the early 2000s where they made horrendous decisions. So the rules and regulations that are implemented are there for a reason, partly to enforce a social responsibility on them because they can't rip off. And even the inquiry that we touched on a moment ago into supermarket price gouging, you know, there was this perception, which was proven to be largely true, that the supermarkets, when they, you know, adjust their prices, they're often sort of playing with us as consumers going into the supermarket every week to do our shopping, that they're really ripping us off. And so we need this change in regulations to ensure that, look, yeah, we want a viable business sector. We need banks. Everybody's got a bank. We need supermarkets. We need all of these sort of things. But this is where the regulation of these things becomes very important. And hopefully you do get a progressive management team and board that makes sure the companies are compliant with a decent social license without the need for the government to lean on them.
Mm. Yeah, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Look, just back on the weather, by the way, I'm talking with Stephen Koukoulis, who's the Managing Director of Market Economics. If you've got questions or comments about tax or housing policy or unemployment or whatever, would love to hear your thoughts. 1-300-800-222. Just looking at the weather radars too, by the way, from Cape Byron all the way up past Brizzy, some pretty heavy-duty weather rolling in. Hasn't quite hit the coast in Brisbane, but it looks to be not that far away. So, look, keep an eye on the radar for you and keep your ears peeled to ABC Radio 2, who will have the latest updates as well throughout the night.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Kate from Albany. G'day, Kate.
Yes, hi. I have a question about foreign currency.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, do you think the Australian government is manipulating foreign currency rates just for trade? So, you know, the US dollar, euro, and the Singapore dollar.
Stephen?
Yeah, the short answer is no. Back for the Australian dollar in particular, back in 1983, they floated the dollar. So it is the supply and demand of money, of Australian dollars from exporters. When they export, say, a tonne of iron ore to Japan, they receive Japanese yen. They then change it back into Aussie dollars to sort of pay their shareholders or to make their profits, as we were discussing earlier. And that buying of Australian dollars pushes the dollar up. However, when you know, we buy a car that's made in Korea. We have to buy Korean won, so we sell Aussie dollars. Look, I don't think there's any genuine manipulation. There's a huge turnover in foreign currency markets every day, and it'd be very, very hard to manipulate. And occasionally in history, we have seen the government trying to intervene in the foreign exchange markets. The classic examples have been in Britain, occasionally here when we had Paul Keating as Treasurer talking about a banana republic and the Aussie dollar went into freefall and the Reserve Bank were trying to buy dollars to sort of stop it from falling too much. But on a regular day-to-day basis, no, I don't think the central banks manipulate the currency, and it sort of finds a level that is meant to be, and I think it's worked very well, that sort of allows importers and exporters to compete fairly, and it goes up when economic conditions are good and goes down when economic conditions are bad. And I think that broad rule of thumb holds.
Kate?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just find it interesting with the Singaporean dollar, for an example, which is used for crude oil.
Yeah. There are manipulations of it though, Stephen, aren't there?
I mean, China, definitely.
The Australian dollar is a classic currency, I think, which does get manipulated by traders because they can.
There are traders who can force the currency to move higher or lower.
Yeah, yeah.
George Soros, the huge fund manager in the US, used to sort of pride himself on being bigger than the central banks, and he used to sort of take them on. And look, I should just clarify what I was saying too, but yeah, for example, some countries do have a very well managed, that's a polite way of putting it, manage their exchange rate. So the Chinese, for example, do determine what their currency is, and the government and the central bank there determine exactly what it's worth every day, and they change the value according to their whim. And this is where, just if I can go on a slight tangent here, that one of the issues with the China-US tariff wars, if you can call it that, is that the Chinese are sort of retaliating, if you like, to the US tariffs by pushing their exchange rate lower to give them some competitive advantage to their exporters. So, yes, there's a bit of manipulation. And, yes, the big fund managers can push the Aussie dollar up and down and the rest of it, but it's harder to do now than back in the olden days when there was less liquidity in the foreign exchange markets.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Kate. Why can't Australia create a sovereign wealth fund like the Norwegians have, says my texter. Sick of selling coal, iron ore and gas, and none of it benefits the owners, who are the Australian public. Yeah, well, I think, you know, hands up for that. Anyone who's been to Norway and see the high standard of living that Norwegians have, I can tell you, they've been a lot smarter than Australians. That's for sure. Angus, g'day, Angus.
Yeah, g'day. Mate, my question's just about the role of unions in our I guess, macroeconomic landscape at the moment. We've obviously seen wages and productivity go their separate ways about 30, 40 years ago, and it seems, in my estimation at least, to coincide with the decline in the rates of union membership and days lost to industrial action. Are we seeing the beginnings of a resurgence, and do unions have a role in, I guess, the return to better wages and therefore a better tax and revenue base for the federal government?
Stephen?
An excellent question. Yes, there has been that big divergence between productivity, not just in the last few years, but going back several decades, and the wage share of the economy now. And that has coincided with the decline, the sharp decline in unionisation of the Australian workforce. Now, I guess a lot has to do with the government of the day, the federal government of the day, and it's interesting that since Labor won the election in 2022, they went to the Fair Work Commission, I dare say really buoyed on by their union members, to push for pretty hefty wage increases to the minimum wage. So I think in the first year it was a 5.75% increase in the minimum wage. In the last couple of years it's been around about between 3.5% and 4% to the minimum wage, and that does sort of parlay through to a lot of other awards. So as we were saying earlier on, there has been some increase in some wages over the last year or two, partly because the economy and the labour market's been relatively tight, but also because the government is keen to sort of play catch-up for the prior decade when, you know, real wages growth was miserable. It was really very, very poor. So there's that question where is it the union membership or the government of the day that is more likely to deliver higher or lower wages? And then again, the influence of the union movement. Well, they didn't have much influence when the coalition parties were in power, and I guess that's just the nature of the political system we have here in Australia.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Angus. Good question. Brendan in Hobart. Hi, Brendan.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question around, you know, small business is the lifeblood of this country.
Very important, yep.
Yeah, we're struggling. So we're 105th ranked in Australia now, in the world, in the Economic Complexity Index. So basically, as a country, we've been reduced to digging holes out of the ground and speculating on property. So we've been talking about the tax system tonight. Wouldn't it be a good idea if we could start rewarding tax breaks for creativity in small business to bring that back and actually start improving and upping ourselves on the Economic Complexity Index? You just spoke about Norway. They're at number 44. We're at 105, I think, behind Uganda. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, complexity. I think that's just sort of another way of saying red tape regulations and these sorts of things. Now, as I touched on before, there is a case for rules and regulations for the way businesses, be they big, small, or medium.
I think he's talking about, aren't you talking about, Brendan, you're talking about the complexity of the economy, aren't you? Or not regulations, Stephen. We're talking about how Australia earns money from things, and we earn money by digging things up and shipping them overseas, whereas more complex economies manufacture things, they have bigger service industries and so on. Is that what you're talking about, Brendan?
Correct, yeah. But as a result of that, indirectly with the red tape, small business is struggling as well. Yeah. So it is sort of directly linked, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Stephen.
Yeah. No, it is an excellent point, because that, what do we call it, the entrepreneurial flair that we want to encourage, that we want to enhance. We want businesses to take a chance with an idea and to have it function in Australia, not go off to Silicon Valley in the US or somewhere else to be monetized and to be turned into a big business. So I think I agree completely that we'd love to do that. And, you know, we saw some discussion of that at the Productivity Roundtable back in August, but alas, that hasn't really led to anything just yet. Hopefully there's something brewing within the Treasury in Canberra that we'll see soon. But look, the Australian economy, yeah, we are still a pretty good economy at the end of the day. And just because we dig stuff out of the ground, we shouldn't be embarrassed by that. If we've got,
I mean, someone's got to do it, Stephen.
Someone's paying us for it. If you found a $50 note in your front garden, would you be embarrassed by it, or would you be happy? I'd be pretty bloody happy if I found it. So we're blessed with those natural resources. And yes, but having said that, I do agree that we do want to facilitate, I suppose is the right word, and encourage that entrepreneurial flair where we see great ideas come to fruition within Australia. Now, not all of them will, but it'd be really encouraging to see, and this is where I get a bit of a disappointment with the CSIRO cuts, for example. Now, I know they're a government institution, but they come up with a lot of really good ideas, and just at a time when we need to be seeing good ideas and science enhancing rather than, you know, more money necessarily being spent on, I don't know, mining exploration and the like. That can still happen, of course. It's disappointing that those areas that are the high-profile intellectual artificial intelligence sort of areas, the ones that require clever scientists to work on them, perhaps are not getting the money and the funding that they require.
Yep, okay. Thank you. 1-300-800-222. My texter says, yes, but have a look at the tax the Norwegians pay. How happy would you be if you were taxed at that level? Well, this is, I suppose, a discussion we're having right now. We have these tax rates, but the part of the problem in Australia is getting people to, well, getting corporates in particular to pay tax. Do you know anything about the CSL share price? William in Box Hill says it's dropped 40% over the past 12 months. What's going on?
I don't know a lot about CSL. All I do know that it has fallen sharply. Not exactly sure the reasons why. I think some of their innovations have not been going well in the US, but I don't know a lot about CSL.
Okay. Sue in Applecross. Hi, Sue.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
I missed most of the discussion, but I got in when you said, Philip, that we need to tax corporates on their revenue as opposed to their net profit, or their gross profit. And I agree with you there. You know that ordinary people pay the majority of income tax in Australia.
Yeah, they do.
We pay about, I don't know, 65-70%, and corporates pay the other 30. So there's a direct problem there that can be easily rectified by your suggestion so that we do get the revenue in. But on the other side of the register, I want to know why we want to give this government, in particular the Labor government, more money to do with what? I don't know. We just lost $100 million on that battery that we have invested in for solar energy recording or holding off. What the hell do I want to give more money to this government for? This country, Australia, is going down the drain. Yeah. We're going down the drain fast because they're spending it on rubbish. We haven't got decent hospitals here in WA, but we're going to get a racetrack. Oh, yeah, that's great. It's going to cost millions of dollars, and that's only the estimate. As we know, governments always underestimate projects. Oh, it's only going to cost $500 million. Ends up costing $1 billion. Where does that come from? Out of the ground? Yeah, it comes out of the ground. So I'm not going to give this government or any other government that's got similar policies, spending policies that Labor's got, so that they can just spend it on trivial stuff. You know, net zero is costing us a bloody fortune. And China and the US are not on board, and they're not stupid. They're just going to rake the money in and hopefully make their people richer. We're just trying to make Australians poorer.
Okay.
Like, for what? We only contribute 1% of the bloody world's pollution. This is craziness. And Albanese and his mob have got to understand it and get the hell out of government. That's as far as I know. And the problem is we haven't got a better alternative, I know, but we don't want to keep them ruining and bankrupting the country. I can't afford to pay any more taxes for nothing when we don't have decent hospitals in WA. We have lots of great sporting arenas. Oh, we're big on sport, but that doesn't produce export revenue. And we've got to concentrate on producing export revenue.
Thanks, Sue. Good on you. I think we hear the point of view. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Dan says need to stop paying your tax bill until big companies pay fair tax. Well, that's not going to work, Dan. you don't want things, quote, dug up and sent overseas. No. I don't think we're critical of that, and neither is Stephen critical of that. I mean, things have to be dug up and sent overseas. Australia is very good at it. And that's one of the hallmarks of our economy. The question is whether we're taxing it very well and whether there might be a better way of doing it. Hey, look what happens when you're having fun, Stephen. Time flies, unfortunately. So our hour has disappeared. Very good to talk with you as always, and appreciate your time.
And thank you, Philip, and thank you to all the callers. One of the highlights of my life as an economist. Thank you very much.
Stephen Koukoulas is our guest tonight, a practicing economist, of course, and managing director of Market Economics.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.